Crash number 13122, Mr. Ron Dinnins, reel 9.
Mr. Dinnan, reel 9. Did much happen then, other than this constant training at Halesworth, of note?
Well, personally, it happened that I got married during the period we were there. I took a week's leave and went up north, and my wife and I were married at a place called Temple Sowerby, which was in Cumbria. From there, I was also sent on a driving and maintenance course at Keswick. And this course lasted for 3 weeks. We took part in driving, mainly driving, under the conditions in that rather mountainous area. Driving up mountains along tracks, really getting into the rough side of driving, which was very good indeed, because I had never experienced such type of driving before, except for the short period in Iceland.
This was your first drive, because you'd had the other course had been a maintenance course. Was this your first driving instruction?
Yes. This was intended to give me a much broader look into the necessary requirement of a training officer, transport officer. And it was very good, because I knew very little previously about driving, because I had done very little driving for the simple reason I didn't possess a driving license. I had driven a truck in Iceland on the odd occasion, but that was all.
So it's quite unusual to have a transport officer who couldn't drive properly.
It was. This was my main objection to taking on the role of transport officer at the beginning. I knew my weaknesses, and I didn't want to let the colonel down because of my lack of training in maintenance and driving. However, it was an insight for me, and I learned a lot whilst I was on that course.
So you went back from there, still at Halesworth?
I went back to Halesworth, where we carried on normal training exercises.
Now, as you were there quite a while, were you aware of the move towards... It was all building up to D-Day and Overlord.
Yes.
Were there any signs, other signs that you saw?
Oh,
the
yes.
Training brought in?
The signs were obvious that an invasion was getting imminent, because not only from news items, but the general feeling and training was geared to invasion tactics. The infantry were mostly involved, so as much training as possible was given over to invasion type training.
What sort of thing?
Well, they had to learn to be deposited in anything up to 4 feet of water and learn how to look after their weapons, whether rifles or Bren guns, when the crossing might happen.
So what happened next then?
We moved from Halesworth to an area around Thetford.
When was that?
That was in early 1944, and it was fairly obvious that things were about to happen, although we didn't know any dates at that time. The training there carried on as normal, and it was obvious to us that large movements of troops into the area, that something was imminent, when that became obvious more every day.
Okay. So, what happened? Could you continue?
Eventually, we were given a date, and the vehicles were then all loaded up, checked and rechecked, that everything was there, so that when we had to move, we would be complete as a unit with everything in its place.
They were actually waterproofed or just ready?
Yes. The idea was that you waterproofed the vehicles part way, leaving the last minute adjustments when you were about to land. This enabled us to move eventually down to the docks in London, where we took off from the East India docks.
And when was that?
We eventually left the marshalling area on the 8th of June down to the East India docks in London, and had to load the vehicles onto a cargo ship, which was took rather longer than we had expected.
Why was that? What was the problem?
The problems were mainly the weather. The dockers didn't seem inclined to want to work any extra hours if it came on to rain.
Now, had you heard of how the actual D-Day a couple of days earlier had gone?
No, we hadn't heard, because the troops were taking on board ship miles away from where we were. So we didn't know how they were getting on until we arrived in France, where we all met up together.
What was the crossing like?
Well, the crossing itself was very good. It wasn't rough at that time, although the weather changed very shortly after we touched down in France, because the Mulberry Harbour was knocked about, rather, when a storm blew up a few days after we had landed.
So you got there, did you get there on the 8th, the same day as you set off?
No. We had to get... Once we were seaborne, we had to wait our turn in landing. It was a question of queuing up, because there were thousands and thousands of ships all riding at anchor, waiting their turn to land. It was a very, very precarious situation, because we were rather helpless. And we were actually attacked occasionally by German aeroplanes, but we were lucky and we weren't hit at all.
How did... Now, you were just the MT, that you had all the trucks and things with you. How did you actually get ashore? Did you land at the Mulberry?
We actually landed in 4 feet of water. I sat in the driving seat, in the passenger seat of a leading vehicle, and I was rather horror-stricken when I saw the bonnet disappearing under the waves, and eventually came up and I found it was roughly 4 feet of water, and we all got away safely.
The waterproofing worked then?
The waterproofing had worked, and worked 100%.
You'd driven off the ramp into 4 feet?
Yes. We were guided, there were guides and signposts of where we had to go, and we followed the instructions. And as we had been taught, you had to stop as quickly as possible after going through the water. to remove the waterproofing materials from the electrical parts of the vehicle.
Could you just explain why? I think it's fairly obvious, but if you could explain for the tape.
The reason for this, that the plugs, for instance, and the rotor arm had to be dry, so it was essential, because you needed air to these parts, that we had to stop and remove these particular pieces of equipment.
So that they could only go so far without air?
Yes.
And then they'd
yes, that's
die.
Correct. And it wasn't until we got to the reception area that we then set about removing all the waterproofing materials.
Was it easy enough to get off?
Oh, quite easy to do. It only took a matter of minutes and the vehicles were cleared.
Well, the beaches wouldn't be under fire at all at that time, would they?
Oh, yes, yes. The vehicles, the beaches were receiving attacks from the German aircraft, but as far as we could gather, it hadn't interfered very much with the duties of people working on the beaches.
Were they within shelling range at all?
Yes. I wouldn't say shelling range, I'm not certain on that point, but certainly from aircraft.
So you went inland, took your waterproofing materials
yes,
off.
And went to an assembly area, and where apparently we were the first of our brigade to be ready to go into action.
Which brigade was that? Can you just remind me?
This was the 70th Brigade and contained the 10th DLI, the 11th DLI and the Tyneside Scottish, which of course is really the 12th DLI. And we had to wait until the 11th and Tyneside Scots got ashore and joined us in the reception area.
And whereabout, do you know which beach you'd actually landed at? They had these code words, Juno Sword.
Yes. We arrived actually on Gold Beach, as there were other arrival points, but that was our direction.
And how far inland? Your reception point was just inland, was it?
The reception was a mere 3 miles away, I think, from the coastline. A small country village was where we stopped for some 2 or 3 days.
Now, did anything much happen in those 2 or 3 days?
No, we spent the time there checking and rechecking everything, and the colonel awaiting orders and instructions of what to do next.
So, when you got orders,
The unit went into battle within a few days at a place called Saint-Pierre.
That would be on the 16th of June, round about the 16th of June?
Yes. We were the follow-up division to 50 Division, who had been the leading division in the attack on the invasion.
What do you remember? I mean, transport officers aren't frontline troops, if you see, they weren't in action. What do you remember about Saint-Pierre?
Well, I was concerned, naturally, to see how things were going and what was required. So I was up at the battalion headquarters awaiting results of our first battle and attending to such things as replenishment of ammunition, petrol, and attending to the catering side, because the cooks had to be set up in a separate place, and I would then arrange all the different companies' rations had to be taken up to wherever they were. We had conferences constantly, and because I, as the troops were on the move, I had to know exactly where they were to enable me to take up their breakfasts and their evening meals and anything else that they required.
How did you actually work with the colonel and, say, his adjutant, his admin?
Well, I didn't see much of the colonel, actually. It was more to do with the adjutant in his department.
This is Tony, you don't remember his name, or yes, the colonel, yes. But is Tony an Irish name?
Yes, yes. And the quartermaster.
Who was that? Do you know? No. And how did it actually work, the system?
The system was that I would report to the adjutant each day, sometimes more times than others. My main concern was the exact location of the troops.
And he would have that information?
Yes. I would look at the map in his office and show exactly where the troops and the line was. This was important because to enable me to get the meals to the men was through their company truck, and they reported to me at a given rendezvous, and there we would transfer the meals to their 1500 weight trucks, each company getting their own, and they would then go off to their company headquarters.
Now where do you got the food from? The food would be in the three tunners, would it?
Yes.
And where had they picked it up from?
Well, we had what they called A echelon and B echelon. Now the cooks were at A echelon, where I was, and I had my motorcycle there, and I would liaise with the quartermaster as to where the troops were, to the best of my knowledge, and gave him the opportunity of doing his part, playing his part in this.
And what was that?
He looked after all the cooking. This had nothing to do with me, really. All I did was carry the meals up and ensure that they got to the companies and platoons.
So the three tunners would take the food from the quartermaster's corks?
Yes. At a given time, I would tell the drivers of the three-ton trucks involved. They would go then to the cookhouse and put aboard all that was required. Usually, we got one three-tonner was enough to carry the food.
For the whole battalion?
For the whole battalion. And then we would do this morning and night.
And three-tonner would go to the rendezvous with the company trucks?
Yes.
Now, where had the quartermaster got the food from? Was that brought up by the Army Service Corps, or would you bring that?
No. I used to collect the rations when required, going back to wherever the RASC had their headquarters. These rations were given to us according to the unit.
And what was the B echelon in this? You said the A echelon was the cooks.
Yes.
And yourself.
The B echelon was the heavier vehicles, mainly the three-ton trucks and the workshop vehicle, which was a technical vehicle where the technical sergeant was and the MT sergeant.
Right. So you were doing this. So would you see any of the fighting at, say, the Battle of St. Pierre? You just get the news coming in at headquarters?
Yes. Well, generally speaking, I didn't know much about the battle itself. But I could see what was going on by the shelling and overhead aircraft moving about. It wasn't difficult to know where the actual front line was. If it moved at all, the movement was generally quite small, a few hundred yards at a time. So there was no great difficulty in knowing the situation.
Did you ever go forward to the front line yourself? Or that wouldn't be part of your job particularly, but would you go forward?
I didn't go as far as any front line troops. I went to their company headquarters. That was about the nearest I would get. Normally I would try and make contact with the company commander to find out if he had any problems from the transport side, naturally. And this just went on as an everyday occurrence.
Did you have to dig the vehicles in at all? Or were they camouflaged? How did you conceal?
Yes. The A echelon vehicles were all camouflaged in some way or other to try not to give away by lighting fires and that sort of thing. We camouflaged as far as possible all vehicles within the echelon.
What sort of techniques did you use? Or would there be an expert come along and advise?
Oh no, most of the drivers knew how to camouflage their vehicles. There were no problems.
What did they do?
Oh, they all had camouflage nets to put over the vehicles, added with branches of trees or whatever was necessary at the time, or make use of bombed out buildings, that sort of thing. The personnel usually dug themselves into a weapon pit just to try and ensure some safety. And I had a backman who was responsible for digging a weapon pit where I could sleep, if I got any sleep.
What else would your batman do for you?
Well, he was there to attend to my requirements.
What sort of thing?
Ensuring that I got a meal when required, and looking after my personal things, and arranging for somewhere where I could sleep. Although I had no sleep for 8 days. The first 8 days I had no sleep whatsoever.
After the battle started or after you landed?
After the battle started.
I see you've done a list here of the battles that the 10th Battalion had, and it's almost continuous. St. Pierre, Juvigny, Searles, Tessel Wood, Hotot, Fontenay, Lefebvre. Can you separate them out in your mind, or was it just a continuous period of fighting as far as you were concerned?
Well, the battalion were very much involved, and I only recall coming out of the line for a rest for one day and going straight back in again to the battle. And then they were in constant movement all the time.
Was it this constant movement that meant you couldn't, as transport officer, you couldn't get a rest?
Yes, partly due. The fact was that there was so much to do for a transport officer to keep the unit going. I had to, for instance, if a vehicle was blown up or lost in any way, I had to then find a replacement as quickly as possible to keep that company up to date.
Now, how would you go about that?
Well, I used to have to get back to base, even to the beaches. In the first few weeks, everything was on the beaches. Ammunition I had to go for, petrol had to be obtained, and food. And this meant you were on the move all day long and got little time to get any rest.
How did you feel after 8 days without sleep? How did you cope?
I was lucky if I lay down between midnight and 2 o'clock in the morning. That was the only time I got to rest. But I think I was in such a state that I couldn't sleep, and just lay down and rested, because I knew I would have to get up again shortly to get things moving before dawn.
Did that cause you any problems, lack of sleep, lack of proper sleep?
No, I felt a little tired, perhaps, but I think with the whole situation put your nerves on edge, rather, and you felt you could continue.
Now, they did have chemicals to keep you awake, tablets. You didn't need
No,
them.
I didn't use anything at all at that time. It was just a question of keep going. And there's a thrill, I suppose, an excitement of everything going on. Really, you got to a very high pitch. And the question of rest didn't seem to bother anyone. The troops were the same. They just got little snatches of sleep, so I gather. And one just went on and on.
Were you suffering many casualties amongst your vehicles and your transport section?
Yes, the vehicles especially got quite a hammering, and I was almost daily going back to get replacements or spares. They were set up by the Royal Engineers for any vehicles that were knocked out, were put into a sort of pile, and one just went for spare wheels or parts to fix up any of your own casualties, and that was almost a day-to-day job.
Were you losing drivers at the same time?
Fortunately, we were very lucky in that I didn't lose any drivers at all.
Not even wounded?
No.
So what was the cause of the vehicles? I mean, what were they being hit by? Was it
shelling. You see, you didn't know where the shelling was coming from or when it would come. So any vehicle was certainly at risk, no matter where it was in the area. It was at risk of shelling.
But you were just lucky that it didn't hit the camp.
Yeah. We were very fortunate, I think, that the only vehicles we lost were jeeps. We lost two or three jeeps who had received shrapnel more than being hit directly. There was shrapnel.
They hadn't mentioned the jeeps. They were in addition to the complement. When did you got them?
Well, we had the jeeps whilst we were in UK.
Were they instead of the pickups or as well as?
Yes, they were instead of the pickups because the pickups were not a suitable vehicle for.
What did you think of the jeeps? Because they were quite new then, weren't they?
Oh, yes. They're excellent, actually. I don't think we could have won the war without the jeeps.
What was so good about them?
Well, they were four-wheel drive. They were a very efficient little vehicle that could go into any kind of ground, whether it was water or mud. They were excellent. Absolutely.
And what were they used to carry?
Well, the jeeps at that time were fitted out especially for carrying stretchers. And they were used right up to the front line to take wounded away. This framework was fixed to the vehicle and could carry two stretchers.
Would they carry anything when they were on the way up?
If necessary, they could carry any particular requirement. If I wanted something urgently, they certainly were a most useful vehicle. I don't know how we could have done without them.
And they were the things that mainly got damaged. What about your big trucks? Were they not hit by shell fire?
Well, as the 3-ton trucks were all at B echelon, which was usually half a mile back from the front line, so we didn't have much trouble about getting knocked out.
What about your 300 weights?
The 300 weights,
the company lorries,
were usually nearer the company, but still not actually in the front line. They'd be a few hundred yards behind. We had very little trouble. It was mostly shrapnel type.
And to the Jeep?
Problems, yes. And I used to then go back to this dump, vehicle dump, and pick up whatever I could